nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so this week we're going to continue our transition from talking about molecular systems, or at least completely molecular systems, toward material systems. And so our next stop along the way is to talk about surface chemistry, still keeping in mind, right, the molecular features that we're so good at designing. Okay, so we're going to be focusing on this very famous topic, subassembled monolayers, or SAMs as they're abbreviated. And of course, we can, the philosophy of this, as we talk about the details, is that you're basically imparting molecular properties onto surfaces. So all the things that we picked up so far can be and have been translated or exported to surface chemistry. So in fact, everything that we do really, right, has to do with some kind of interface. So surface chemistry is just kind of all around us. But this really formalizes the relationship because we're physically putting molecules in an oriented fashion onto a surface and thinking about how that contributes toward some net function. Okay, so I will give you an overview of a number of topics. It's a huge area, again. So here again are some reviews. Every 5 years appears, there's another good review coming out. So there may actually be a more recent one than this, but I haven't identified it yet. But this is more than enough to cover everything we talk about today. This is probably the most comprehensive review. There's over 1,100 references in there. And it's rather encyclopedic in nature. So not one that you need to read and cover to cover, but very well done. A lot of good details. Okay, so let's look at the anatomy of a subassembled monolayer. There are actually two groupings that we can consider. I'm going to focus more on the second for today, but I would be doing a grave injustice if I didn't talk about the more common type of subassembled monolayer that has actually dominated 20th century science. Okay, so the very useful way to make subassembled monolayers, which doesn't really involve specific chemical interaction, is to take a biphasic interface, okay, and that can either be air-liquid, right, or liquid-liquid, right, or, of course, liquid-solid interfaces, but by that time, we are losing the mobility of one of the phases. So really, let's think about this in terms of a liquid interface. And this can be done in a very generic fashion. You're basically taking molecules which have some potential for orientation, be it some sort of hydrogen bonding potential or polarity or electronic dipole, and you're able to orient them in a particular direction by some physical or chemical force. Okay? So very broad. And perhaps one of the most common ways to do this, at least at the air-liquid interface, is a procedure known as Lamier-Blodgett film deposition. Okay, so you see this abbreviation here, and I didn't give this sufficient introduction here, but LB stands for Lamier-Blodgett. This is a very generic way to deposit molecules in some organized form onto surfaces. Okay, so here's the basic scheme for doing this. Okay, so if you... So in fact, I have one of these in my lab if you ever want to check it out and practice. But what it consists of is a trough that contains some liquid, generally water, okay? And you have a coating of molecules on the surface, right? And how you put those molecules on there really depends on your technique. But let us say that if this is water, it's easy to deposit some organic liquid on there where the solvent evaporates away. And so whatever solute is inside there is left as a residual film on the surface. Okay. So if you deposit the right number of molecules on here, they can be very well spread out. They're not going to be highly organized. So, you know, we can imagine it looks something like this. Most of the molecules do tend to be amphiphilic, right? That is, they have a hydrophobic tail and some kind of hydrophilic head. But there won't be much organization at all on here, other than the fact that maybe the heads like to be stuck into the water phase, right? It lowers the surface energy of the system. But the way that you create an organized film is actually a mechanical process. So you have at one end a substrate, and at the other end you have a barrier that can be shifted over just by mechanical force. You can either drag it over, usually there's a motor that attaches. But basically you are compressing the film by reducing the surface area slowly moving it across. So as you're getting this to pack, then of course the chains will eventually align, right? And so this is really a matter of compression, right? You're covering by reducing the surface area, you force the molecules into a close packing arrangement. And given that there is some penchant for the molecules to be directional, right? That is, the more polar parts of the molecule will be faced down at the air-water interface, right? Then the tails are left sticking, pointing up into the air. Only they're no longer really pointing in air anymore, are they? They're really solvating themselves. So you're creating a miniature face, right, by compacting these together. Okay, so at some point you created a closed-packed monolayer, okay? And if you're to keep pushing, right, there's only two things that can happen. Either that the molecules will be pushed into the water, or they'll be pushed on top of each other, and you start to go from a monolayer, which is what this is, to multi-layers. So the procedure for the Langer-Blodgett film preparation is that once you get to this stage, there's usually some sort of pressure gauge, right, that tells you, right, that the surface pressure is starting to increase exponentially. And at that point, if you want to actually transfer these onto some substrate, you can now slowly extract this substrate, right, at the same rate that you are compressing the film. And so it's really a very mechanical process by which you are pushing these things onto the film. And it can go both ways, but mostly we think about this in one direction. Okay. And so in the end, right, you have, you know, this monolayer, right, more or less faithfully transferred as a monolayer onto your solid film substrate. Okay. And for the most part, we don't worry too much about the nature of the chemistry of the substrate versus the head group, right? The head group and tails are oriented purely as a matter of their compression on the Langer-Blodgett substrate. So this transfer, right, has nothing to do with the chemistry between the head group and the surface. It could be glass, it could be Teflon, it could be metal, right? It doesn't really make a difference, right? Because really we're using mechanics to transfer the film. Okay. And so once that's done, you can start the process over if you wish. Okay. And so for example, if you were to pull this up, and there's still molecules left, and then you push it back down, right? You can create a double layer, right? So one where you have the tails pointing up. And then because you're pushing down, right, you're changing the direction, and then you can put a second layer where the molecules have the head grooves sticking up, right? And then you to pull up again, right? Here's your third layer. And then you push it down again, you have a fourth layer. So you can actually control the orientation of different films, right, just by how you're pulling and pushing the substrate in and out. You, of course, can just do this one way. You can pull it all the way out, start over, immerse it, right? And then that way you can just get a single orientation and you just do this multiple times, right? Right? And of course, instead of pulling it up, you can push it down and you can orient the layers that way. So it's really a very versatile technique, right? As long as you're not too worried about the atomic arrangement of these molecules on surface. So of course, these are idealized pictures, right? How organized are they? How ordered are they? Well, it depends very much, I guess, on your technique and perhaps some, very subtle chemical interaction between surface, substrates and molecules and, of course, molecules with each other. Okay. But by and large, if you're just thinking about this as a greasy layer and a water-loving layer, a hydrophilic layer, you can create these kind of films without thinking too much about, right, the overall orientation, right? It's pretty much guaranteed that you will get this orientation, net orientation, by a matter of force, okay? So it's about a 100-year-old practice now. People continue to use Langer-Blodgett film formation for being able to put coatings on all sorts of things. So really very useful. Okay. So, and of course, in addition to molecules, you can deposit whatever you like that's floating at the air-water interface, right? So nanoparticles, for example, right? You could transfer films of those onto there. So proteins, if they were to float the interface, could be transferred too. So very generic process. Okay, the second class, and one that we're really going to spend most of our time thinking about, is chemisorbing self-assembled monolayers. Okay, so chemisorption, right, implies that there is a specific bonding interaction between the head group of a amphiphile, right, of a particular molecule, and the substrate to which it's bound. Okay, and this is really considered to be a formal self-assembly process. That is, if you simply immerse a metal substrate that likes sulfur, okay, so we're going to work with gold, right, as our poster child as our test case. And we're going to work with thiols. So just about everyone knows that thiols have an affinity for gold and vice versa. Okay. So if you were to simply immerse some gold surface, a clean gold surface, in a solution containing thiols, right, with the sulfur head group, right, then these molecules should adsorb onto the surface. And what is more, right, the potential, the chemical potential for driving thiols adsorbing to the gold is sufficiently high that you would actually try to get as many thiols on the surface as possible, right? And that would actually encourage the chains to come to a closed pack form. Okay? So in the previous slide, right, this is pushed together by some external force, right? It's actually a physical force. And this is really driven by chemistry. Okay, so the self-assembly process is more or less a coordination of thiol ligands on the metal. Okay, and then the molecules will, of course, arrange themselves in a way that maximizes their interactions. Okay, so you might say that molecules that are arranged this way, right? They're stabilized by van der Waals packing, right? Just simple packing effects. That's true, but to raise a question whether that's actually the driving force for forming these films, I guess that's debatable. Really depends on the conditions and how you look at this. Okay, so this is the typical picture that most people show when they talk about these chemisorptive thiols on gold, alkane thiols on gold. Okay, and they show it as a nice uniform layer, right, and how nicely organized the molecules are. The chains are perfectly extended. Okay, and we will work with this mental picture, but before we do, I should show you what it really looks like. Okay, so this is a typical gold surface. Okay, so gold or other kind of metal surfaces aren't really that flat in reality, although we like to think of that. We can find flat regions, but really gold or metal, right, is generally not terribly flat, okay? And or maybe there are flat regions and there are islands and ridges, so it's not going to be one continuous plane. Okay, so there's all sorts of defects inside of here, right? So these are grain boundaries, for example, so maybe you do have a relatively crystalline surface on the top here, but in between you'll have defect sites, right, that causes a net orientation of the next domain that's over here. Okay, so the substrate's not perfect, okay? And the thiols, while molecularly they may be all identical, but their ability to self-assemble or form self-assemble islands, they're not perfect either. Okay, so maybe 90% of the molecules, or even 95%, will form the classic self-assemble monolayer. Okay, but there's going to be defects all over the place. Okay, so you can have a defect at in between domains. So these molecules maybe are kind of leaning to the left, and then molecules which form a perfectly stable monolayer or lean to the right, and here you just simply have a gap. Okay, and there's really an entropic component to this, right? It's very hard to get a perfect two-dimensional crystal of molecules anyway, right? But given that the surface is not perfect, certainly the monolayer is going to have plenty of imperfections too. Okay, and so this is very common, right? You'll have gaps in here just because, right, it's a stochastic process. Molecules will pick in, and eventually you'll get so full that maybe molecules just can't find their way in there, right? So you'll have missing sites where molecules just simply didn't make their way in. Okay? You'll have, dirt on the surface, imperfections of different sorts, and other kind of chemical impurities, and all these just contribute toward toward what is really a real surface, right? So whenever you're working on something, you're assuming a beautiful carpet layer of molecules like this, right? And then you start to do some kind of physical studies, maybe electrochemistry, and you're finding that you're getting weird results that you don't expect. No matter how you change the molecular layer, right, you're still always getting some anomalous result. It's very possible that the actual physical process you're studying is taking place through these kind of imperfection sites. So one always has to be careful in a real setting, right, that you're working with something that is free from pinhole defects like this or this, right, and that you actually are working with, right, a truly uniform layer. Making a perfectly uniform layer is actually very hard to do. You have to really work at it, right? Both getting a clean surface, a uniform surface, and the way that molecules deposit in. Okay, so that's the reality situation. But having said that, for the most part, we have found ways to look at the chemistry that's provided by, right, the more or less uniform portions of these SAMs. Okay, just didn't want you to walk away thinking that everything, right, occurs by magic this way. There's actually plenty of reality shows its ugly head plenty of times when it comes to interacting with these monolayers on surfaces. Okay, so now, if we do try to go after a perfect film, we better understand the interface on which these dials are absorbing to. Okay, and so I need to talk about the substrate, and this is really a materials issue. So I'm going to give you a quick introduction to how people describe surface substrate interfaces. Okay, and actually maybe you already know it, but I won't take any chances. We'll just kind of go over this for the next 10 minutes or so. All right, so we're going to be talking about gold a lot, and gold likes to form, in its crystal state, the gold likes to form an FCC, face-centered cubic structure. This is typical for most metals, not just gold, silver, iron. Most metals in their bulk states will form the FCC structure. Okay, and this is what it looks like. And it's very easy to remember, especially after we go a few examples here. But here's the unit cell, right? Space is a cube, right? And every face, right, has a atom on it. So there are six faces. So there are six additional, 1, 2, 3, 4 back there, 5, and 6, right? There are six additional metal atoms, right, in addition to the 8 vertices. So there's the total of 14 atoms that make up this particular cell. Okay? 6 plus 8. Now, this is a good place to start talking about the nomenclature for looking at different faces or planes associated with FCC structures. All right, so it looks like a cube, but actually we don't usually interface with it like a cube, okay? So given that this is a unit cell, we're going to say that this dimension, x dimension, is h, going to give that an index, okay? The y direction, we're going to give an index k, and the z direction will be the index l, okay? And the HKL system is classically known as the Miller index, okay? This is just FYI, right? So these three numbers, right, or these three parameters will help us describe the actual nature of the face that we're looking at. All right, so let's walk through this. All right, so let's just say this is our origin, right, three-dimensional Cartesian system, and we want to look at the 1-0-0 lattice, okay? So if you just simply go from here to here, that's, right, a step of 1 in the each direction, right? And so here, right, red atom goes to red atom, right? This red atom goes to red atom, and so on. So the relationship between this back set of atoms and this front set of atoms, right, is just simply a translation, right, of one step in the each direction. Okay, so this is a 1-0-0 lattice, and it looks like an X, but actually if you fill it in, and you'll see this on the next slide, this is really a square lattice plane. Okay, you'll look at the arrangement of the atoms as if they are, right, a closed pack square lattice. Okay, now this is not the only one, right, actually every plane in here is a square lattice. So here there's only 4 black atoms, right, but this also, of course, square lattice. It's rotated 45 degrees with respect to this one, but that's not correct. It's not rotated. It's actually, it's just simply translation displaced, right, with respect to this one. But all three of these, right, are 1-0-0 planes associated with the 1-0-0 lattice. Okay? So we're thinking about looking at it along this face. Okay? Now, if you change the direction, so instead of going along the H direction, you go in the K direction, so go from here, forward one, to this position, right, then now we're talking about the 0-1-0 lattice, okay, and really it's identical to the 1-0-0 lattice, right, but we're just simply, you know, taking into account, right, what direction we're going on. It's a very symmetrical structure, so, right, this, and of course this are all going to actually give you the same information. It's just that their orientation with respect to us is different, okay, but that's why we're doing this, right, so here we're going from here to the back, right? So that's going along the K direction, so it gives us 0-1-0. And here we're going from, let's say here up one, right? And so that would be the 0-0-1 lattice based on our definition, okay? All of them are square lattices. Now, let's say we go from here as our origin. So we go along H1, we go along K1, and then we go along L by one unit, okay? So now you're going from here to here, okay? And so here is the atoms colored in, right? Same FCC structure, just the atoms are colored in to show off the 1-1-1 lattice, okay? So this one, right, which if you extend out all the, you know, if you expand this structure, you'll see it has its own plane, right, will match with this one over here, okay? And this plane, of course, will match with the next one that's not drawn in, but it's over here. But you can see that there's, right, 3 or 4 planes defined in here just by the way that you're cutting, right, across in this sort of a diagonal direction. Okay. And so that's one, that's a 111 lattice, that's a 111 lattice, and so on. Okay. And you can probably tell already, but we'll see even better on the next slide, that this is a triangular lattice. Okay. Let's just do this one more time. So let's say we start from here. Okay. So we go one in the H direction, and then we want to go minus one in the K direction. So actually would put us here, right? In our direction. And then we go up one. And so if you were to draw that in, that's what this would look like, right? So there's an atom in the back that you can't see as our starting point, but you went one over, right? One forward and one up. And this is known as a 1-1-bar-1 lattice, okay? Negative one, okay? So all we're doing is really shifting the orientation of this by 90 degrees, right? So that this atom is pointing out in this direction here, okay? And now here you can really clearly see, right, the triangle lattice that's associated with the 111 plane. This is the most common lattice plane that we interface with. This is the most stable plane for a reason I think will become clear in a couple of minutes. Okay, so we're always working, or we're usually working with the 111 lattice planes of gold, okay, which is a triangular lattice. Okay, so here's an expanded set of FCC, right? So I've gone to a, instead of just looking at this, I've actually doubled the dimension of this. I think it becomes much more clear now, okay? And we're just going to look at this again. And so here again is a 1-0-0 plane. And now you can clearly see, right, that this is a square lattice packing here, right? And if we were to do all the orientations, right, here's your next square lattice. That's clearly, right, also, right, has a fourfold symmetry to it, okay? We haven't done anything else except just simply, right, expand the directions of which this the additional lattice atoms would go. Okay. And then here again, that 1-1-1 plane, or really 1-1-bar-1, right? You can see all the triangular planes that are underneath this first atom here. Okay. So if it just extends out infinitely, right, each one of these should be the hexagonal plane. All right. Now, these are the most stable planes because they are close packed. Okay. And so, of course, the hexagonal ones are more stable than the square lattice ones because, I think you can just judge by the fact that there are gaps in here, right, that this is not as space-filling, as close-packed, as the triangular one. So in a sense, right, that's true, but I think more correctly, we think about this in terms of the compacts, right? So for any triangular, or perhaps we should call it now hexagonal lattice, it's the same thing, right, any atom here would actually have six additional atoms contacting it from the same plane, right? Whereas in this case, you only have four contacts, okay? And then if you were to think about this in three dimensions, right, then on top of this, right, you would have, right, three atoms down here, and you would have three atoms in the back. So there's really a total of 12 atoms that are touching any one of these in a 1-1 orientation, okay? Well, but I think the important part is to think about this in terms of a surface, right? So in the case of a surface, you have six atoms around a single one, and you have three more underneath, the second plane underneath. So that gives you a total of 9, right, atoms in a 1-1-1 orientation, right? 6 in the same plane, 3 on the bottom. And here, right, you have 4 in the same plane. And then if you were to think about this, let's just take a look at another plane here. But you just think about this going backward. You really only have about 2 atoms, I think, supporting one underneath. Okay, so it's only about half in terms of the total bonding allowances provided for you. So that makes the hexagonal lattices by far the more stable. If you cleave this and you show the square lattice, of course, you know, that's what it is, but it's a much more high energy state because these atoms are not as strongly coordinated, right? They have fewer coordination sites filled than you have in the square lattice. Okay. So actually when things interact with 1-0-0 plane, right, there's a lot more energy changes that take place. And that sometimes actually leads to a corrugation or roughening, a reconstruction of the surfaces of these planes. Okay. That's one of the reasons why we're going to be working with the most stable plane, because it doesn't change on us. Okay. And the energies are more or less well defined. And even then, right, as we're going to discuss, it's still actually a lot of energy to direct, you gain a lot of energy when something chemisorbed like sulfur binds to any one of these gold atoms. Okay, but that's the basic argument, right? The hexagonal lattice is the most stable and the easiest to obtain, right, before you treat it with some kind of chemisorptive molecule. Okay, Then there's other ways to cut this block apart, right? So we've only so far looked at square lattice and triangular lattice, but actually if you were to, say, cut it at a 45 degree angle with respect to one of the axes between in the KL plane, then you can get to another kind of lattice. So here, this one's called the 0-1-1 plane. Okay. And we call this a slip plane simply because it's possible to take, you know, a big cube of FCC coordinated atoms and to apply the correct kind of pressure to cut in that direction to reveal, right, the 0-1-1 phase. So it's possible to get this by applying force in the right direction if you know the orientation of the atoms. Okay. Actually, I probably should have mentioned this. Although we call this a square lattice plane, all of these, in fact, are, formally speaking, are slip planes. You know, if you apply the right pressure, you can reveal square lattice, you can reveal the triangular hexagonal lattice, right? And now you can start to reveal lattices that are neither square nor triangular, right? So here's one that's very clear. This is the 1-0-1 slip plane, right? Look at this. Look at the space between these atoms here, right? So this one, you don't even have full contact between the gold atoms. Yet it's possible to reveal this if you, right, orient the crystal of, your gold crystal correctly and apply your knife in the right direction. Okay, so this sort of things has been done. Terribly unstable though, right? There's a lot of empty free spaces that would love to be filled up by something else or just simply by reorganizing the atoms. Okay, so all the possible repeating orientations, right, can be achieved, but the ones that we're going to be sticking with is just a closed path triangular lattice. Too many words there. Okay, so that's going to be our assumption. We're working with this triangular hexagonal lattice of gold atoms, and we're going to introduce thiols here. Okay, so how do the thiols end up being, you know, this kind of perfect uniform lattice that we're going to enjoy drawing? Okay, so there actually is an evolution that takes place, and it may or may not be what you think, but this has been studied in great detail, especially back in the 1990s. So we're going to go over some recent history about this. Okay, so if we start with a very clean gold surface, okay, and that's really, again, right, a real feat to achieve. You don't want anything else on the surface, not aluminum or polymer deposits or dust, right? If you have a really perfect clean gold surface, you can study these surfaces by things like scanning tunneling microscopy, right, or, you know, something that gives you atomic level resolution to see what happens when molecules bind and adsorb onto the surface. So in the case of alkaline thiols on gold, when you introduce the first few molecules on a gold surface, they actually will kind of scatter around. They'll form perches, but they don't stick upright. Okay? There's no reason for them to actually stick the tail up off the surface. So in fact, right, the molecules would rather lie prone, flat against the surface, and they'll stay that way until there's sufficient amount of activation to get them to stand upright. So first molecules come in, and eventually you'll get to a saturation where the molecules are still all lying down. And so here's actually an intermediate picture of this. This is a scanning tunneling microscope image, an STM image of alkane thiols on gold 101. Okay, and it doesn't really look anything like what we've seen yet so far, but what I can say is that these striped highways here are actually molecules that have been organized into these lying down flat domains, right? These prone structures here. So these stripes, right, are actually regions where the molecules are not standing up. Okay? And of course, right, chemistry will continue to drive this forward. And so the interaction between the thiol and the gold is strong, but the hydrocarbon, the CH tails, right, and gold, there really isn't much interaction. It's weak van der Waals forces. So these aren't going to stay stuck on here. They're very easy to lift off, right? It's a very weak interaction. So when another thiol comes in, you'll display some of these, and eventually you'll get a critical mass, and you will form, right, an island where the thiols do start to pack together, right? Now, what drives this? Drives this is, right, the fact that you have that many more sulfur to gold interactions. That's the enthalpy behind the system. Okay? So the fact that the chains pack together like this is kind of a forced consequence of that sort of interaction, right? When you get enough thiols to get on this, right, what's the best way to do this? If you had one every three molecules standing up, right, then each chain is kind of unsupported, right? And that kind of takes a lot of energy from an entropy standpoint. So the reasonable thing for molecules to do, for thiols to do, is that if you want to accommodate, right, an additional number of sulfur atoms on the gold layer is to pack together these molecules in a way so that they're self-supporting. In a sense, this is very much akin to our hydrophobic effect, right? Where we're trying to, right, minimize the entropic loss, right? So you actually want molecules to come together because the restructuring around those molecules by, say, solvent, right, is just too energetically costly. But if you get them to solve each other, right, that may be more beneficial. And there is, of course, some mild enthalpic gain here, van der Waals again, right? And so the best orientation is for an island to form where the chains are all close packed against each other. Okay. And so this is the beginning of a new crystalline domain. It's two dimensional. Okay. And again, you can probably see some of those in here, right? So if you look at some of these, right, which look more regular and closer packed, this is actually an island of structures that look like this. Okay. And of course, if you were to do a scanning, you could probably tell the difference just simply in height, right? That these are kind of low and that these are, of course, going to be much higher. Okay. But this again is just the intermediate along the way. So once you get this, now more molecules can stand upright. Actually, it will nucleate and grow further, right? So more chains will continue to migrate there, and eventually you'll get, of course, the maximum coverage possible by saturating as many gold atoms as you can with the thiols. Okay. So what is that exactly? How many sulfurs can you get onto a gold 1-1 surface? Well, it's a very easy recipe. Okay. So if you just think about one sulfur atom, right, the sulfur atom will actually, well, it's hard to see here. I wish I had another picture, but a sulfur atom will typically fit between, in the hollow side between three gold atoms. Okay. That's a maximum contact it can have. You don't have to worry about valence counting, right? It's not one sulfur, one gold atom. It doesn't have to be that way, right? What's best for the gold layer is to be able to have, right, as many gold atoms in contact with the chemisorbing agents possible. So the best arrangement is actually three gold, one sulfur. Okay. And then the question is, how many more molecules can you fit in that way? And that now pretty much has to do with the size of the thiol itself. Okay. So if we just take a simple thiol, like it's like an octane thiol, C8 thiol, right? What we have then, you can see it's very periodic lattice here. And if you look at this cartoon, what you see is that, right, that this sulfur atom, which is buried underneath the chain, right, has a certain relationship to the next sulfur atom, but they're really not that close to each other, right? You don't maximize as perfectly as you could. There's three gold atoms here, right, in contact with sulfur. There's three gold atoms here in contact with sulfur, and again, right? So in that sense, every gold atom is taken care of, right? Every gold atom has a third of a sulfur. So in terms of monolayer ratio, is 33%. Okay. But, you know, you could have fit another sulfur atom closer, like maybe you could move this over one over here, right? And then that way you could actually increase even more, right? The ratio of sulfur to gold. But that doesn't happen simply because, right, the chains will get in the way of each other. So it turns out that the best packing arrangement for something like alkane thiols on gold, right, is this 1-to-3 ratio. And you, because of the spacing, right, that the chains will allow, you actually we'll get these to orient in a certain way so that this forms a super lattice, which is its own hexagonal lattice, is expanded by about square root of 3. Okay? Just simple math. Okay? And the additional detail, and it's really only a detail, is that if you look at this, it kind of looks like a flathead screw, right? This is actually the orientation of the hydrocarbon chain, so the way the carbons are zigzagging, right? They're more or less zigzagging along this direction. Right, and then it alternates, and then you get this. Okay, and this is known as a herringbone packing. Okay, it's just a very fine detail that people have been able to extract out of things like surface scanning tunneling microscopy. Okay, so that's the full anatomy of the famous alkane thiols on gold self-assembled layers. Okay, so you have every third gold for every three gold atoms, you have one sulfur, and it forms its own hexagonal lattice. In addition to that, to get the maximum best packing arrangement, it's been determined that you have this herringbone lattice. Okay? So that's how that works. And what is really remarkable about this is that if you extend the carbon chain length, go to 12, 13, or 18 carbons, this doesn't change, right? Because, right, the packing of the chains, right, doesn't go any larger. It's not that they need any kind of elbow room, right? Once you form domains like this, this is basically a crystal. So you actually can get, right, a further extension just simply increasing the number of carbons. Now, this, of course, is the best case scenario, which is one of the reasons why it's so well studied. But, you know, it is really remarkable to know that, you know, that you can play a modular game in here. You can stick in, right, molecules at different chain lengths, still be able to get the same kind of orientation. All right. So STM, which is the image that you saw on the previous slide, is several ways that are used to characterize these monolayers. So in fact, it's, one that the experts, there's only a handful of experts in the world that can produce beautiful images like that. So for chemists, right, we don't do that much STM, at least, at least, you know, you have to have the expertise to do it. So there are other characterization methods, that relate to the chemistry to show how well your monolayer has been formed. Okay? So in the absence of something nice like STM, people use, this technique. This is known as X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy, XPS. Okay. And this basically is a form of elemental analysis, right? It does two things. One is that it tells you what molecules are actually adsorbed onto the surface. So if you know that molecules are on there that are thiols, you should see a signature corresponding to that atom. So there's actually electronic transitions that correspond to molecules that are adsorbed to the interface. Okay, so sulfur in particular, since it's so important to us, actually forms a doublet, right? And the doublet, it has to do with the fact that there are actually two different electronic states give off different energies, right? So one is called the 2p3 3/2, and the other one is the 2p orbital in the 1/2 spin state. Okay, and this is a very characteristic 2-to-1 relationship. So that's a signature to show us that we have sulfur at the right energies, right? Usually in this region here, right? That we have sulfurs on the surface. Okay? And if you, this is good enough to tell us the bonding energies. So if you look at this one versus this one, you'll notice there's a slight shift. Okay? This actually is the XPS spectrum of sulfur that's just simply adsorbed on the surface, not chemisorbed, but just physisorbed on the surface. It's stuck on it without any specific chemical bonding. And here is a thiolate, we would call it S minus, right? But once it's on the gold surface, there's no charge. So this is actually from the S gold bond. And notice that there's about, well, in this case, about 1.5 electron volts in terms of the energy difference for the full electron spectroscopy that gives it that as characterization. Okay. And then, of course, if you have a surface with a mixed number of states, you have the chemisorbed SAM, and you have additional molecules just kind of sitting on the surface, not with any particular bonding, right, then you can get a spectrum that looks like this, right, but we have software, or there is software available that helps you, right, do some curve fittings, right, curve fitting routines, and it tells you that this is a ratio, in this case, of 40% free and 60% bound sulfur, okay? So this is one of our most common tools for looking at the quality of molecules bound to the surface. It doesn't tell us that what the organization is like, it's really just a quantitative measure of how many sulfur atoms there are and what their binding states are. Okay, so this is something we're going to read about next week when you get involved in your projects. Okay, of course, vibration spectroscopy has been very useful. Right, there's a lot of modalities for IR that involve surface spectroscopy. So surface IR is useful, and that pretty much is the same way that we use traditional IR, but you're just reflecting off the surface to get the signature. In the same category, there's, instead of IR, you can use Raman. And I will talk more about this in a couple of weeks, but both IR and Raman, can be very useful to know something about the chemical nature of the molecule stuck to the surface. Okay? So these are three of the most useful tools available to chemists, at least when they know that they have a monolayer on the surface. Okay? And then, more people want to know how thick their layer is. That's another characterization. If you, in fact, do have, right, going back to this cartoon, if you do have a true monolayer, then this should have a thickness that's determined by the chain length as well as by the tilt angle that it's at, right? But this should be measurable. And in fact, right, that's yet another technique. So the method known as ellipsometry can give you an estimate of that thickness. If you're good at it, right, you can measure down to angstrom level how much the difference change in thickness is. Okay? So this is another quality control in many cases, but also if you have new molecules, you want to know, you know, something about the orientation, ellipsometry is very useful. Okay? And the list goes on. There's only one more I'm going to just mention here. This is something known as a near-edge X-ray absorption fine spectroscopy, NEXAFS. And this actually is sensitive to the tilt angle of the molecule. So one thing you probably realize in looking at some of these cartoons that the molecules are not always sticking directly up, right? But actually that they have a certain tilt angle to them. Okay. And this has been used to measure something like that. Okay. This is a good starting point if you really get interested in studying SAMs, right? This covers all the techniques just listed here, but there's actually even more. Okay. But, characterization of SAMs is just as important as characterization of supramolecular complexes, right? Just the tools change. We don't use NMR or X-ray crystallography, right? Use these kind of tools instead. Okay, any questions to this point? All right, so let's go into a little bit more detail about, right, this alkene phthalates on gold, okay? Because this has really been used by lots of people. It's very reliable, right? If you have a clean gold surface, right, and you're careful about how to do the SAM preparation, you can really impart these molecular properties onto SAMs, right, by just simply by force of modifying the end groups here. Okay, before you do that, right, there's some details here that probably you should know. Okay, so first of all, right, the assumption that these chain molecules do form some nice organized layer, right? We have a minimum number of carbon atoms. Usually it has to be at least an octane phthial before you get this good organization. If you start to work with shorter molecules, of course they do stick, but there really isn't enough of a driving force to get molecules to pack well, right? Entropically, it's still actually somewhat favorable for the molecules to be in different orientations. So usually if you want to have a guarantee about this kind of structure, you need to work with at least 8 carbon atoms. And 12 is better, and 18 is, home run every time you want an orientation. Very greasy though. Okay. But there's a minimum number of methylene carbons necessary to get good packing. Okay. So assuming that we have that, right, these chains will always pack with a certain tilt to them. Okay. And the reason for this has to do with the fact that, again, the sulfur atoms are spaced out, right, in this, 3 gold atoms, 1 sulfur ratio, right, and there is a gap between here, right, and that if they were standing up straight, right, there would be basically voids, right, voids that a molecule couldn't take up, but nonetheless, there's empty space, okay, and if there's empty space, right, the molecules could move around, but right. If you want to get them to form a stable layer, then just like any kind of crystal, right, they should form some order structure. So it turns out that the most stable form is for the molecules simply to lean over, and a tilt angle is very precise. It's actually about 27 degrees, right? And there's a good matching. I mean, not only are all the molecules, of course, now in contact with each other, and there's not much of a penchant to go back and forth, but there's actually a good match between, say, the hydrogens of this carbon and the crook of the CH2 over here, right? So there's, right, again, this good form fitting. Okay. So packing is really what determines the, how the molecules might like to tilt over. Okay. If you're to change this to something else, so let's just say, for example, I'll just make it up. So instead of carbon, let's just simply say you had silicon, say, right? And assuming that the molecule was chemically stable, bond lengths change, right? Then of course this tilt angle would change based on the next lowest energy minimum that it could find. Okay. So it's very sensitive to the fine molecular structure. Okay. But since you just deal with hydrocarbons all the time, this number comes up very regularly. Okay. Now, what happens if you start to work with carbon chain lengths? Just, you're adding one methylene unit at a time. Okay. And so if you look at this one, there's 9 carbons, right? And then some X group. Okay. Could be anything. And here we have 2, 4, 6, 8 before the X group. So the difference in carbon is 1, but I think you can tell just by looking at this that the orientations are very different. Okay. So these are sticking up straight, right? More or less projecting from the surface. And these are sticking off at an angle defined both by the tilt and of course by the sp3 hybridization of the carbon chains. Okay. So this is a very common odd even effect, right? If you were to use an odd number of carbons, right? Which one's the odd one? If you use this is 2, 4, 6, 8, 9. If you use an odd number of carbons, right? That whatever this terminal group is, is going to be sticking up, right? And if you use an even number of carbons in the chain, right, then the terminal group will be sticking up the direction. That changes the surface property considerably. Okay, so something to just simply keep in mind. You can read about it in this paper if you like. Okay, very substantial difference. Okay, so now how about other groups? So of course, you know, maybe we want to put on something more interesting than a methyl group or hydroxyl. So let's say we want to work with something like this, an azobenzene, right? It's a very common dye. It's one that can actually change its physical conformation. So if you put this molecule in, this of course now starts to perturb how close these chains can pack, right? Because no longer are you determined by the cross-section of the polymethylene linker, you're now actually limited by the cross-section of this group on here, right? So this may be the orientation that's favored for methane carbons, but now these are too close to each other. You have a strong steric clash in between them. So these are going to want to space out, but now that causes spacing down here and maybe also introduces some disorder to the chain. So this packing geometry, right, especially of the head groups that maybe we want to dial in, can greatly influence the sort of head groups that we have in here. Okay? So how does one get around this? Just if you want to impart some kind of interesting chemistry to the surface, but you also want to retain this very nice packing, which is quite stable, what do we do? Just kind of a thought experiment. What should we do if we want to put some molecules on the surface? So remember, right? This is a self-assembly process, right? We are more or less, right, just simply introducing thiols onto this to get out the lowest energy structure. Okay, so let us say that we want to just have a few of these in here. Okay, that's maybe enough to impart some interesting property. All one needs to do is to mix, well, let's just say 10, 20% of this with, right, 80, 90% of the simple hydrocarbon chain. Right? And given that these chains are approximately the same length as those chains, right, what should you expect to see? Well, one has to do the experiment, but it's reasonable to propose that you'll get mixed monolayers, right, where, right, 90% or more of it is dominated by this, but, right, 1 out of 10 can be substituted by a molecule like this. So now you can do this without sacrificing, right, good organization here, and still perhaps have enough molecules on the surface to provide you with some kind of interesting function. Okay. So something to keep in mind, right, for your future needs, that if you are going to take advantage of surface chemistry, you're not restricted from just having to use one type of molecule, right? So just based on your understanding of how SAMs form, right, you can mix different molecules together, right? And of course, thermodynamics still, you know, is a very key factor in this, but it's very likely that you could identify, you know, by, you know, a priori, something where you get something well-defined and still be able to have some interesting surface function, molecular function on the surface. Okay? So it's kind of practical advice for your future. Okay. Anyway, right, you know, if you do have molecules that are not commensurate with good packing, right, you get disorder, you can still form monolayers, just maybe the monolayers aren't that well organized, right? And that influences stability. So one of the reasons that we care about this is you would really like to have the most stable system if you're going to find some application down the line. Okay, there's more ways to go about doing this, and we'll cover them, but this is a consideration for now. Okay, so what are the kind of surface properties that we can change? Well, there's all sorts of things we can do, but probably the most basic one that you should be aware of is that by coating, you know, something like a gold surface with molecules, is that you change their wettability. Okay, you change the way that solvent liquids interact with that surface. Okay, and the most important one that we care about, of course, is water. Right. So if you put on some just hydrocarbon chain, you know, dodecan thiol, right? And dodecan thiol, right? X would be CH3. So this is what this would be, right? So those are methyl groups sticking straight up, right? How's that going to interact with a water droplet? Well, I think it's pretty obvious, right? That, you know, when you ever have a hydrophobic surface, right? The water droplet's is going to bead up. Okay. And the quantitative description for this is what is known as the contact angle, okay? And so a lot of people, right, the first thing they do whenever they perform, make a SAM, right, with different kind of functional groups on here, is to do a contact angle measurement, okay, to give them some idea of, you know, what molecule or what functional groups are sticking up and maybe how many and, you know, things like this. And of course, you know, single numbers isn't so useful, but comparing, right, several different systems, right, and the change in contact angle can be very helpful. Very easy thing to do. You just need a microscope that's focused at the interface and you look at the side and you look at how the droplet shape is and you should be able to see a picture like this. And the contact angle is nothing more than the tangent, right, of where this droplet, water droplet usually, right, hits the surface. And so this angle is just an easy, convenient number to make some comparisons. Okay. Now, typically, we would think of the contact angle shape, or sorry, the droplet shape, to be defined by the surface, right? So if you have a bunch of methyl groups here, hydrophobic, right? And so it doesn't want to form a good droplet like this. It's going to form a droplet that looks like this. Okay. So that contact angle, maybe I should just draw it on the board so that it's very clear what we're talking about here. Right, so we have a bunch of methyl groups on the surface, and the droplet, not drawn to scale, right, is going to look something like this. And the contact angle is defined from inside the droplet to the tangent that we're just describing. Okay, and that's going to be greater than 90 degrees. Okay, and so for most people, if you're in a region of 100 degrees or 110 degrees, right, we would call such surfaces being hydrophobic. Right, and here on the screen, back to the screen, if you look at the droplet, the angle is much less than 90, right, then it's no longer hydrophobic, and the angle, of course, is very low, let's say less than 30, maybe you can't even see the drop anymore, then people typically classify that as hydrophilic. Okay, so very easy to make these kind of correlations. It's qualitative, right, the actual value, again, isn't so important, but you just are, if you're in these regions, right, we assume that hydrophobic equates to well over 100 degrees. Hydrophilic is well below 30 degrees. And then you have intermediate states. Okay. Now, the problem with this thinking, although I think it's very convenient to think about this way, the problem with this thinking is that the shape of the droplet isn't actually due 100% to just the chemistry interaction, not purely so. Okay. Or maybe more proper, appropriate to say is that the surface energy, right, this gamma term is actually an interfacial surface energy defined here, right? Maybe by itself isn't the best way to describe how the droplet interacts with the surface, right? It may be more important to look at the edges, right? So the droplet is actually defined by what is known as the contact line, where the droplet edge meets the surface. That's the most important part, okay? So, of course, you still have methyl groups here, right? But the ability for the droplet to form, right, to spread across those methyl groups is very limited. And that's really what's responsible for that kind of shape over here. Now, there's lots of things that go into this, right? So this is assuming a perfectly flat surface. You don't have any bumps along the way. But we already know, right, that surfaces, substrate and molecular packing are imperfect. And those defects and roughnesses can cause droplets to also increase their angle. So there's like, so all of these factors have to be taken in. So all I'm telling you for tonight is that from the most crude, the first degree of approximation, right, we can correlate, right, the surface energy of these structures, right, hydrophobic, hydrophilic, and so on, with the contact angle, but there's just a lot more to the story. It's just simply a convenient way for us to gain some idea of the properties. But the actual interfacial surface energy may not play as important role as what has been described in literature. It's a point that's been argued by many different people, and we won't go into it too much today. Just would hate for you to leave to think that, right, that this formula, which is known as the Young-Dupré equation, right, always gives you this prediction here about what the angle is. Okay. So we're only going to look at this from a practical point of view. Okay. So that is, right, you have, you know, hydrocarbon termini, right, methyl group, vinyl group. The contact angle is on the order of, say, 100 to 120 degrees. Right, and if you keep following the scale here, right, you have molecules like this, right, contact angles are going to be close to zero. Okay, so these are not measurable, right? By the time you get to 60 or 50 degrees, it actually gets hard to look at the structure. It's not as reliable. But this more or less meets our very simplistic thinking, right, about this wetting property, right? Hydrophobic here, high contact angle, hydrophilic in these groups, right? Well, not measured, but basically, right? Water soluble. Hydrogen bonding takes over. Okay. So, much more about surface properties perhaps later on. Okay. But I just want to introduce you to one of the many practical ways to do this, right? And so contratangle goniometry is one of them. Okay. So this is one where we actually kind of touched on, but I think I want to go into greater detail. Okay. So we want the assumption in doing all this chemistry is that this is a reliable way of getting molecules to stick to surfaces, right? You have a thiol, you plug them in, we have an idea what the density is, we have an idea how the chains pack, right? And we can use it to do many things. And so therein lies part of the problem, right? We would, of course, like to go ahead and do that, but if you propose to use an alkene thiol-coated Salmon gold for some application, right? There are things that, of course, knock the molecules off, right? Still, chemistry will happen, okay? And one of the most important chemistries, actually, is redox chemistry. So when a molecule is adsorbed to the surface, right, these are formerly thiolates, okay? But, of course, gold is conducting, and I think many of you know that gold can be a catalyst to a certain extent. And so one of the things that it can help mediate is a protonation or protonation or electron transfer of molecules on the surface. And so it's actually well known that if you put thiols on the surface and just simply wait long enough and you have a way to remove or collect protons and electrons, these things can actually desorb in the form of disulfides. Okay. So this chemistry just never stops. Okay. And disulfide formation, of course, right, can lead to the degradation of the surface and introduce all sorts of defects. Okay. So a freshly prepared SAM, right, can be useful, right? It does age. If you expose it to oxygen, of course, oxidation will occur. So here's another example of that, right? So here, if you introduce in some oxygen and the presence of light, right, been shown that the thiols will turn into sulfinates, okay, RSO2 groups, okay? And now the sulfur itself no longer binds directly to the gold surface, but in fact, it's thought that the oxygen takes its place. And the strength of the oxygen gold binding isn't nearly as good as the thiolate gold binding. Okay, so oxidation is another way that these molecules degrade. And of course, this doesn't stick around as a sulfonate forever, right? This gets further oxidized into the sulfonate. Once you're here, there's really practically no chemical interaction. These will be easily washed off by some water molecule. Okay, so the interaction, the chemical interaction between here starts to go way down, right? So this is the beginning of the end, further oxidation, right? The molecules just basically are easily displaced by something else. Okay, so packing is one thing. That's useful, right? But protecting these from the environment is also kind of a necessary evil for these sort of things. You can do lab experiments where you control the exposure to oxygen, the exposure to light, and perhaps exposure to heat and proton exchange, but only to a certain extent, right, will these survive in an uncontrolled environment. Okay, so we've just spent a lot of time talking about thiols on gold, right? And people have been using it for a long time, so we need ways to get around this. And there are ways to get around this. A couple of them are listed here, but I think what most people agree on today is that at least as a first step to get molecules to organize onto a metal surface, thiols can't be beat. Pretty useful, right? They're very reliable and you can get them. And if you're then to take that and do further chemistry on them, let's say, for example, some cross-linking, right? Or some polymerization on the surface, right? Then, of course, you create something new, but perhaps, right, that coating, right, can be sufficiently stable to do the other things you want. Okay. But the one thing that most people agree on is that over time, these thiol molecules will leave from the surface. Okay. So, let me start actually on the bottom part here. So here are a couple of ways to get around this. So the one way that most people have looked at least is to take molecules that are multidentate, right? It's the supramolecular approach, right? Don't rely on one interaction. You can rely on many, right? And so by doing that, you're, of course, increasing both enthalpy and entropy in your favor, right? So you have a cooperative interaction between multiple sulfurs onto a metal surface. That's certainly very possible, right? And in fact, it's what's been shown is that even when you have very weak molecules, so for example, these sulfides individually, sulfides don't bind to surface very well. They can, but it's a very mild interaction. But if you choose the right molecule, like this one here, there's three sulfurs in this adamantine-like structure, this actually turns out to be pretty good in this interaction, right? So if you look closely, if you do this by design, the relationship between the sulfurs and the gold atoms can be optimized so that it fits very well onto the surface. And this is known as simply good epitaxy, right? When you have a good relationship between the sulfurs and the metal surface, right, then that binding can increase. So the thiols on gold was good epitaxy, but it's only a single molecule of sulfur a single atom of sulfur per molecule, so it's easy to get good epitaxy. If you design a multi-dentate structure, this is not a good choice for gold 1-1, simply because the symmetry of gold 1-1 is trigonal, right? It's threefold, and this is fourfold. But maybe it's a good geometry for gold 1-0-0, right? Should you be working that surface. So one can try to design molecules that can have a stronger attachment to the surface, right? Something that really should be considered. Of course, one doesn't have to work with thiols at all. So here's an example where we use a group, not thiols anymore, but carbodithiolates. Okay, so this is a CS2 unit on a carbon chain. This actually sticks very nicely. And this is a dithiocarbamate. This is really easy to make. If you've taken the mean and you react it with carbon disulfide, you form more or less the same group. Okay, and the nice thing about these systems is that the distance between these two sulfurs is about the same as the distance between two hollow sites on a gold 1-1 plane. So the interaction, again, has this epitaxial character to it, right? It's a good match to the gold surface, and that helps increase its binding. Okay, so if you choose the right chains here, you can, again, of course, go back to the same packing argument, but it's already been shown that dithiocarbamates are more robust than thiols when put under comparable conditions. So there are actually lots of good ways to go about, right, functionalizing metal surfaces other than just plain old thiols. Plain old thiols are very convenient, but, you know, we might like to, think about the chemistry a little bit more. Okay? Here's yet a third class. This is about the same category as the thiols we talked about. It's just that again, the geometry of packing is different. So these are aromatic thiols. And molecules like these also form well-packed SAMs, but now, because of the cross-section here, it's different from methylene chains, these actually point straight up. Okay, it's been shown that there's no tilt angle, or very little tilt angle associated with them, about less than 5 degrees. Okay, so there's lots of variations on a theme that you should think about. So if you get to the stage where we're starting to design things, right, well, you certainly should consider alkene thiols on gold, but maybe you shouldn't stop there, right? There's lots of ways to put molecules on the surfaces that may be appropriate for, a future application. Okay. So, we have a few minutes left. I think I can finish this, but I should check to see if anybody has any questions. Okay. All right. So next week you'll get, oh yes, go ahead.
I'm just curious, how strong is the gold sulfur bond?
Okay. Oh, thank you. Very good question. I should have addressed it much earlier. So, it's been, there are measurements for this interaction, and, the going number is about 40, kilocalories per mole. Now, that's an approximation, and it very much depends on the environment around it. So, if you're to do this in a protic solvent, methanol or water, that's much weaker, right? Because the proton, not shown here, but the protons can jump on and off, right? So if we're in a situation like this, right, if it's a protic solvent, right, then this can desorb off, right? True for hydrogen bonds too, right? Depending on the solvent you use, the hydrogen bond can be stronger or weaker depending on the ability to undergo exchange. But, when your back's against the wall, a good number to work with is about 40 kcals per mole, right? Gas phase, you have thiols on gold trying to pluck a molecule off into a vacuum, 40 kcals per mole. Okay. So halfway there between covalent bond and some of our supermolecular interactions that we've talked about. Okay. Let's move on then. So this is really where SAMs try to make their money, right? And so, of course, there's just studying SAMs for their own sake and then trying to apply them to something. And there's just tons of really interesting applications. I won't do justice to all of them. The reviews do a much better job, but I should at least give you a sampling of what's available. Okay, so one of the things that SAMs have been applied for to do is to create the stimuli responsive surfaces, environmentally responsive surface. If you can trigger a change, right, by shining light or changing the electrochemistry or, you know, doing some kind of introducing electrons, right, then you might be able to, right, adapt that to the surface. And so here's a good example of a photoresponsive structure. Okay, and so this goes back to azobenzene, right, which we've seen already. So azobenzene is known to either have a trans configuration or cis, and this can be switched back and forth just by choosing the right wavelength. Okay, so one wavelength will go from cis to trans, and then a longer wavelength will push it back down to the cis form. Now, you put this on surfaces in the proper orientation, right? Here's what you can get. So this actually was done not with thiols on gold, but just the old way, the first way, I should say, using Langmuir blotchet and that kind of assembly. And so here, right, the molecules, right, are shown that are straight up. They represent the trans configuration. Okay. And if you put other molecules on here, you can control their orientation too, right? So this helps propagate that nomadic phase of the liquid crystal, right? You can get an overall orientation of molecules in the normal direction. Now, if you shine light on this and you cause these to bend, okay, now there's no longer a stable interaction between these two, right? So if we're just considered packing effects, these molecules might rather like to lie down, right? And of course, once that happens, then you nucleate a transition, right? So in the end, you can actually get a reorientation from all net direction pointing up to net direction pointing in the plane. Okay? And so that's an example of just changing the surface chemistry to change the orientation of materials on top of it. Okay. There's also just simply structural modes. People have found that it's very convenient to make molecules that are functionalized to, say, create artificial lipid membranes. Okay, this is a very popular activity. Lipid membranes themselves are kind of fragile, right? They're volatile. They're flexible because they have to be. But if you put them on a surface, you can greatly stabilize them, and this helps slow down certain processes and make it easy to look at molecules that would otherwise embed itself. So here in this particular example, they have this kind of a cushioning. They use thiols to orient these oligopeptides, which then can have these covalently attached phospholipids. And so this is actually an artificial membrane layer, right? So they bring in things like these proton pump membrane-associated proteins, and these can then be fused with the surface, and now you have a structure like this. Okay, and this is a kind of form of supermolecular chemistry, I think we can say, but one that, you know, you rely on the stability of this first form, and then to use that to form a bilayer. Once you get to a system like this, by the way, right, now we start asking this question about stability again. Well, sure, over time, right, this system may not survive, right, being an aqueous solution for too long. However, right, once you start to put on multiple layers, right, then the degradation of this may not be as critical as in the past, right? So the idea that the monolayer is stable or not often has to do with how much stuff you have on top. Okay, so this in itself is a self-stabilizing system in the sense that this is no longer the weak link here. If there's any weak interactions, it's going to be at the membrane phase here, right? Because the molecules are not held together by any kind of covalent force. It's just self-assembly of van der Waals interaction. Okay? So, just want to try to provide this balanced view on the relative importance of, right, chemisorption onto gold, right? So, depending on what goes on at the top, right, you can often get away with a lot, but just have a care. Okay, so how about our connection to supermolecular effects, right? I mean, that's what really our class is about. And so, of course, this has been done a lot, right? And so, same idea, right? The thiols on gold, right? You could, of course, now start to put on other molecules. So this addresses our earlier comment, right? If you wanted to do self-assembly on a surface and maybe to be able to create sensors or different natures of that, right? Not every molecule has to be the guest or host structure, right? You can just simply have a few percent of the molecules on here mixed in with the stabilizing alkene thiol. So that's exactly what these people did here. And they just wanted to demonstrate that if you have a structure like this and you introduce in a complementary structure, they were able to sense a change, right? From, you know, just a lone host or guest molecule in this case to the host guest structure. And so they were actually able to record change in this by using different kind of sensor technologies. I should now, at this point, probably point out that these are going to be important for us to think about in the near future. Okay, and I don't want to take up too much extra time today. In fact, let me just see how many more slides I have. Oh, all right. So I think maybe what I will do is I will go into a little more detail in the next two slides, and then we'll call the break and push harder on Thursday. Okay, so once you're able to get molecules, right, that have some recognition function in here, right, you also need to couple this with some kind of sensing technology. Okay, so for those who do supermolecular surface science, right, they become very well equipped in terms of knowing what kind of modalities are out there. Okay, so in this case, right, one can use something known as surface plasmon resonance, right, to show a change in the local refractive index. So by having molecules absorbed to the surface, you actually change the RI, refractive index, right, because the chemical nature changes. Okay, one can also use fluorescence, right? If this were a fluorescence structure, for example, you can actually modulate the fluorescence by some self-assembly equivalent. Gold is not such a good choice for fluorescence because metal tends to quench fluorescence in most cases. Later, you'll find we can design gold based on the nanostructure to enhance fluorescence, but for today, let's just simply say that gold and fluorescence isn't necessarily such a good match. Okay, but SPR, surface plasmon resonance, is something that I think you'll want to read about. Okay, of course, there, metal surfaces are very good for electrochemistry, right? So, you know, potentiometry, cyclic voltammetry, impedance spectroscopy, anything that has to do with electron transfer is a very good candidate for sensing differences. So a lot of electrochemists actually have gotten into the whole SAMS game because they already, right, have the expertise to be able to sense very minute changes in structure as a function of, right, electron transfer. So this is very commonly used by inorganic electrochemists. Okay. These remaining tools, spectroscopy, I'll skip for today. I should mention something about mass sensing. Okay. And mass sensing is actually a very good one. If you, again, just take this as our example, if you were to put this on some kind of crystal, a piezoelectric crystal, the crystal will vibrate at a certain frequency. But by putting molecules absorbing on the crystal, right, that changes the rate of the vibration. Okay? So this is a good way to sense how the molecular, the total mass on the surface of a gold-coated chip can be, right? So this is a technique known as QCM, or quartz crystal microbalance. Okay? So here we have an optical method. Here we have a mass-based method. And of course, finally, right, we have a chemical force method, and that has to do with things like AFM, where a probe tip, right, can be used to pull off of molecules or pull molecular complexes apart, and you see deflections in a cantilever that show these changes. Okay. So this is really an analytical science, okay, which I think you're going to be reading on your own, okay, but just to mention it today, right, several different modes for sensing changes of supermolecular interactions. All right, so this will be my case study, test case here. So one of the very good, famous examples in where SAMs have been coupled very nicely to sensing modality was published, again, quite a few years ago, but this is really one of our earlier examples of how well this works. Okay, so these are these calixtrin-type structures, and the calixtrins have sulfur feet, and it was determined that the binding of these onto to the metal surface was such that it would form, again, this nice, stable monolayer. Now, I should point out, right, that this is, right, for most part, fourfold symmetry. It's not a very regular patterning, but because it's multidentate, right, and because the head group is the one that helps define the packing, right, we don't worry so much about what happens on the chemistry down here. It doesn't matter if this is regular or not. What we do know is that with four sulfurs, even though they're in sulfide bonds, they're not thiols, they're sulfide, that this is strong enough interaction to keep the molecules in place, right, which is abetted by, right, close packing between these rings. So given that this is a stable structure, right, they make use of the cavitan, the cavities in here, to absorb gas molecules. Okay, and the one that they found fits the best is actually it's trichloro or tetrachloroethylene, right? And when these absorb in here, that changes the entire, then changes the mass of the molecules that are absorbed to the metal surface. And so here are three different concentrations, gas concentrations, molarities of the tri or tetrachloroethylene. So as they increase it, you can see that there's a frequency change associated with this, right? So the frequency is how you read out the absorption here, and it's more or less, you know, a linear relationship. Hey, okay, here's just another example. This is, let me see. This example here is just kind of a control to show that this is specific to the clixarenes on top. So if you just simply have hydrocarbon chains and you're introducing gas molecules, yes, you do see a deflection here, but the degree to which the deflection in mass occurs is not nearly as strong as here, right? So that's, good validation to say that, right, the selectivity between, right, host and gas molecule is really quite high. Okay, but overall, right, to be able to use as a gas sensor, right, one can functionalize a surface to be able to do this. Okay, so here's a chart of this one. Turns out to be quite specific for tetrachloroethylene. Trichloroethylene is not as good, and chloroform not nearly so good. So this turns out to have an unusually high selectivity for the molecule shown. Okay. Again, this has been followed up by thousands of papers with similar ideas where they change the modality for detection, they change the molecules on top, right? The careful chemistry, the careful science in studying these things is to make sure that you have an appropriate control experiment to make sure that when you have these kind of desorptions, right, that they're not due to non-specific interactions, okay? So again, a word of advice for your future assignments, right, that as we design these devices, you always need to have some kind of control to accompany these, right? Because the idea always looks great on paper, right? But how do you know it's not due to something else, okay? So this is something that you'll need to keep in the back of your minds. Okay, I guess I have to stop here. There is actually a rather large section beyond here, so I didn't finish like I thought I would. But I believe I can finish this on Thursday and still be able to take care of the next slide. So why don't I just simply break here? Okay, and on Thursday, we'll get started on time, and we'll make quick work of surface patterning.